Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to week four in this series of effective living. Before we begin, today is actually a special day. It's called Lag BaOmer in the Jewish calendar. Here we good? We ready? Today is a special day, Lag BaOmer, the 18th day of the Omer. Sorry, the 33rd day of the Omer. The 18th day of Iyar, I mean. Just a bit of background before we begin, and we'll come back to it actually today in the middle of the discussion. Today is the, among other things, today is the Yahrzeit, the day of passing of a great Talmudic sage called Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, known as the Rashbi. The Rashbi lived under Roman persecution in the 2nd century. He was a disciple of the very famous Rabbi Akiva. And what the Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, is most known for is, besides being a very great halachic sage, he was also the author of the Zohar, which is the foundation of teachings of Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic teachings. And in fact, the whole celebration today is very Kabbalistic, because where one normally finds that a Yahrzeit, a day of passing, is connected with some level of introspection or reflection or sadness even, he actually instructed that before he passed away, there's a whole story recorded in the Zohar as it was transcribed. He instructed that the day that he passes away should be a day of tremendous celebration to celebrate his life, because he felt that the day that he passed away, he'd reached his full purpose and his full meaning of his life story, which actually is connected to the discussion which we're going to have today a little bit later. So that's it's an auspicious day. Most noted for traditionally for bonfires in Israel, apparently. This is like all over the place today. In the outside of Israel, it's a few different bonfires at different places last night, but otherwise, yeah, so that's Lag BaOmer. Okay, so we're working through the works of Rabbi Twersky, The Effect of Living, and some of the little tidbits from Chloe Medanis. I want to spend a few minutes reviewing just where we're up to so far. So we've talked about the various layers of the human experience, and putting it all together, we've come up with five, really, which is the essence of the person, then the subconscious, the conscious and preconscious, which you put together, the emotion, and then what we talked about last week was the expressions of the emotion and the intellect, which is thought, speech, and action. Now, we've talked about the concept of the subconscious being the irrational part of who we are, often designed to send, it's a hard drive that holds all of our memories, all of the stuff that we've experienced forever. And then often sends us signals, subconscious signals, or plants thoughts in our mind which are irrational and sometimes designed to protect us, but to protect us mistakenly. The example we gave is like hearing the alarm clock in a dream or going in denial and so on and so forth. And what the subconscious does, as we've talked about, it teams up with the emotions. And emotions also very instinctive and impulsive and irrational, and often driven by the thoughts planted by the subconscious. So we've explained that the goal is to take control of the conscious mind. The conscious mind is a place, or can be a place, should be a place of objectivity, of moral discretion, decision-making ability, and a place where we can learn to be proactive rather than reactive. Right? And we explained that the conscious mind, number three, connects with number one, which is the essence of who we are. The essence, of course, is the place of strength, the place of inner purity, the place where we don't need to operate based on external influences, but rather from an inner strength focused on what is right, not what is being perceived from the outside, but what is pure and correct from the inside, what is selfless, what is moral, what is purposeful, and what has meaning. Now, we also explained last week that the conscious mind connects with our means of expression, which is thought, speech, and action. And therefore, when we take control of the conscious mind to make sure we can make decisions, we can be proactive, we need to do that by connecting, first of all, the conscious mind to the morality and the purity of the essence of who we are, but also on the other end of the spectrum, as we explained last week, to connect the conscious mind to action. Because action, the heart follows the action. That's how we control the emotion, as we talked last week at length from that famous letter that we went through last week from the Tzemach Tzedek, where he wrote to someone who was having these interfering thoughts of fear, which is triggered by the subconscious mind, irrational thoughts of fear, where one of the things he told him is to use his means of expression to remove the negative thoughts and replace them with positive thoughts, positive speech. And then he went on to explain that you need to replace them with positive action. And there was just an amazing expression that we talked about last week. He said you should make movements of happiness every day. And I connected that with more recent research by, what was the name again? I've forgotten. Sorry? No. Anyway, one of the social psychologists that they've done research in body language, that not only body language reflects who you are, but body language can change who you are. And the recommendation of modern science to spend a few minutes every day engaging in body movements of confidence and power and positivity and so on and so forth, which was quite amazing. Okay. Now today, what was that?
A lot of work to make you work.
She recommends 2 minutes a day, Satsabai. Okay. So today I want to develop this a little further. And I want to talk about the concept of motivation. Right. There we are. Because it's very clear, of course, that when we talk about living an effective life, a life that brings happiness, inner happiness, that brings fulfillment, it obviously is hard work, right? And much of the time to actually engage in positive strategies, in effective strategies, we need to invest with effort, invest with hard work and a great deal of motivation and drive. And we know that because it's easier sometimes to take the... It's easier to sometimes take the easy way out and not to put in the hard work. Just going back for a moment to the article by Chloe Madanis in her 14 Ways to Be Miserable. So one of the ways, her second strategy, she says, is practice sustained boredom. Right? She says, cultivate the feeling that everything is predictable, that life holds no excitement or possibility for adventure, that an inherently fascinating person like yourself has been deposited into a completely tedious and pointless life through no fault of your own. Complain a lot about how bored you are. Right. And she says, a side benefit of being bored is that you inevitably become boring, because friends and relatives will then avoid you, and of course you won't have happiness then, because happiness comes from relationships, right? As this happens, you'll feel lonely and even more bored and miserable, and at the end she gives the exercise. She says, force yourself to watch hours of mindless reality TV programs every day. Read only non-stimulating tabloids that leave you feeling soulless. Avoid literature, art, and keeping up with current affairs. Right? So, okay. Now, it's interesting, however, that sometimes we know that certain practices will bring. I mean, although this is extreme, as we've been saying, but there's a strong point that she's making, because often we engage in things that we know is pointless. Sometimes we engage in things that leave us, and we've done this before, but we still do it. It leaves us with sort of a feeling of a bit of emptiness and unhappiness. And we know we sort of have to do not to do that, but we lack the motivation. People complain about lacking motivation and drive. Now, in Rabbi Twersky's work that we're basing some of this discussion on, he talks about motivation and makes a very interesting point. He says that it can be heard at a young age, sometimes people say the students lacks motivation. Or you hear adults say, I've lost interest, right? Or we talk about someone else, they're just not motivated. Or everything's a chore, or that kind of... So often we blame things on lack of motivation, right? Then he says an interesting thing. He says, of course, if we really... I'm going to read it to you because it's very well put. He says, of course, if we really wish to be precise, there's no such thing as not being motivated. Everyone is motivated at all times. A person who lingers in bed until noon because he's not motivated is in fact very much motivated. He's motivated to stay in bed until noon. The negative motivation at that explains. He says the negative motivation outweighs the positive motivation to do something constructive, right? That's a very, it sounds funny, but it's a very important point. We'll see why. In other words, one can never truthfully say, I'm not motivated. Right? Because what you can say is, I have a negative motivation. In other words, in theory, I'd like to get up and go to this meeting or go to shul or go to a class or do something positive. But I'm motivated more strongly to be lazy. I'm motivated more strongly to have the pleasure on a cold morning day to go under the covers and keep sleeping. Right? So what does happen is we're not motivated. We are negative. We are motivated. We're motivated negatively. The only problem is that the negative motivation is pulling us away from our goal. Because sometimes we do have goals, or we think we have goals. And to reach those goals, we have to have a different kind of motivation. It's just that we happen to have another very strong motivation, a negative motivation, which is pulling us the other way. Now, we should mention, just before we go into this discussion, that's not always true. Sometimes negative motivation comes from burnout. Right? And that's something we all need to be aware of. Rabbi Twersky tells a very funny story. He says that, it's the story of the iron. I'll tell it to you. He says a story, he has a son that was in yeshiva learning and living in a dormitory and shared a dormitory room with another boy. Now, in this yeshiva, there was a rule because of fire hazards, so the boys weren't permitted to have any electrical appliances. I don't know if you know anything about yeshiva bachrim, but sometimes they set up in their rooms ovens and who knows what, fridges and all kinds of things. And they weren't allowed to have that. However, the one thing they were allowed to have was a clothes iron, right? Because iron the clothes. So he says the other guy in his room was very enterprising. So what did he do? He turned the iron upside down, wedged the handle in the drawer, and he had a bit of a hot surface that he can make coffee and popcorn and another thing, right? Now, apparently, I don't know, I'm not very electrical, I'm not very technical like this, but apparently the heat in the iron is produced by a very small and delicate filament, right? And when electric current runs through, it becomes red hot and it produces heat. Now, it's designed to use a couple of hours a week, right? And if it's used that way, it will last a good few years. Problem is, when you use it every day for endless cups of coffee and popcorn and other things, it burns out because it wasn't designed to carry that load, and that's exactly what happened, right? Couldn't understand why suddenly his iron broke. And he uses that story, just a cute little story, he uses that story as a lesson that we sometimes just need to know how much we can take and how much we could do in a particular experience. And sometimes if we overload and we do too much that the load could carry, we burn out. And that's when we also feel a lack of motivation. And that's not necessarily negative motivation, that is true burnout. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about when we have the energy or we have the ability, we have the potential, we have the power to engage in things that are positive, and we just lack the drive. Right? Because for the most part, motivation, or what we call lack of motivation, and what he calls negative motivation, is actually a lot deeper than that. And this is what we have to try and break down and unpack. It comes from within, and it comes from a very, very deep place. What motivation is connected with is something which we call in Hebrew ratzon, will, right? Desire. Now, there's a very interesting phrase that we often quote, or Jewish literature often quotes. The phrase is actually not in the Talmud. In fact, interesting that it's Lag BaOmer today, because we talk about the Zohar. It's actually a paraphrase from a paragraph in the Zohar. And the phrase that's always talked about is, Ein lecha davar ha'omed bifnei haratzon, which normally translates as, nothing stands in the way of will. And people sometimes mistakenly equate that with the concept of willpower. So I've got the will, like they say, well, there's a will, there's a way, right? But actually doesn't mean that. Ein lecha davar ha'omed bifnei haratzon, nothing stands in the way of ratzon, means nothing stands in the way, if it's humanly possible, we're talking about if I could do something, or potentially do something, I just don't have the will to do it. Nothing stands in my way for creating the will. That's different, you realize? Ein lecha davar, nothing stands in the way of the will, which means we can control what we want and what we don't want, which is an amazing thing. In other words, we sometimes talk about controlling how we think or controlling even our emotions, but it goes a lot deeper than that. We can actually control what we want to some degree, as we'll talk about later. There's a very interesting, just to give you a little bit of an analogy, it just needs a mindset, and it needs delving deeper, and needs a lot of thought sometimes to reveal a desire, or to reveal an inherently desire, or even to change a desire. There's a one of the great commentators on the Chumash is called the Ibn Ezra. And he makes an interesting comment. You know, we're coming up to Shavuot in a few weeks, and Shavuot is the anniversary of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And in Mount Sinai, of course, God communicated to us to the Ten Commandments. One of the puzzling Ten Commandments is the tenth one, which is Lo Tachmod, do not covet. Do not covet someone else's spouse, someone else's house, someone else's possessions, whatever the case is, right? That's the way it goes. And he asks a question, as many commentaries do. How can God command us to do that? In other words, like this. You can say, don't take someone else's car. Don't pinch someone else's food. But you can't say, don't want to do that. What do you mean? If I want, I want, right? And he says, that's not true. Because you can get to a place where you don't want. Why? So he gives an example. He says, for example, if someone would tell you, scientifically prove to you, that there's an amazing expensive treasure, there's a box of gold coins, he says, or whatever the analogy is, on top of one of the planets, and you really believe that, would you want to go and get it? No. Why? Because any normal person knows that it's completely out of reach. It's out of bounds. It's inaccessible. Something that's totally not accessible, I don't even want. In theory, it would be nice to have something like that, but I don't want that box of coins because I know that I cannot reach it. Therefore, he says, what the Torah is telling us is, not just don't steal someone else's car. Don't even want someone else's car, because if you really believed in Hashgacha Pratit, and you really believed in the way God runs the world, and you really believed that what is coming to you comes to you, what is coming to someone else, and you really believe that what belongs to someone else is meant to belong to someone else, and it's got nothing to do with me, then you wouldn't even have the desire. But you need to really develop that mindset in a very strong way to control that ratzon. Right? So when we talk about motivation, we actually have to talk about not so much am I motivated, I have to talk about how strong is my will, or do I have the will, and where is my will coming from, and where is the will come from when I have negative motivation, and how do I overpower that will by replacing it with a different will coming from somewhere else, and where does it come from? There's a little story from the Baal Shem Tov, famous story. The Baal Shem Tov was on a rainy day. He was sitting with his disciples once, and suddenly someone knocked at the window. Now, you know, you've heard me say this before. The Baal Shem Tov would always say that from everything that you hear and see, you can always learn a lesson in how we become better people and serve God and so on and so forth. So the Baal Shem Tov was sitting with his Talmidim, with his disciples, and there was a window, and suddenly there's a knock at the window. They open the window, and there's a wagon driver. And the wagon driver says to them, can you help me? My horse got stuck. My horse and wagon got stuck in the snow or the mud or whatever the case is. Can you help me schlep it out? He's talking to a bunch of yeshiva bachrim just to start schlepping a horse out of the mud. So one of them said to him, I've forgotten the Russian phrase, but in English he said to him, I can't. So he said, the wagon driver said to him, you could, you just don't want to. Right? So the Baal Shem Tov stopped his Talmidim and said, that's an amazing lesson. There are a lot of things we say we can't, but we could, we just don't want to. And because Ein Lecha Davar HaOmed Bifnei Ratzon, because nothing stands in front of creating a will, we just have to create the will. Once we create the will, we'll be able to do it. Now, obviously, we're talking about things that we know we can deep down. We're not talking about things that are humanly impossible. But we're talking about things that we know we can grow in, things that we know we could do, right? If we take all the 14 strategies of the article of Chloe Medanis on being miserable, we know we can do the opposite. We know we can feel gratitude. We know we can deal with our fear. We know we can do all of those things. But maybe we just don't want enough. And the question is why? And how do we create that ratzon? How do we create that will? So let's go back to the different parts of the human experience. Right? One of the things we've established is this. So let's take this slowly. One of the things we've established is that our personality, meaning how we express who we are and how we respond to the rest of the world and how we respond to other people and other experiences, lives in our emotions, lives in the heart, right? Personality is in the seven emotions. That's where we live, that's where we react. The problem is that by default, if we take the default position of the area of emotion, that is driven by an animalistic drive, right? It is driven by an egocentric subconscious, which is animalistic. In other words, that's where the animal soul lives. The animal soul dominates, the animal soul lives. We know we have an animal soul and a godly soul. Right? We've talked about this many times. The animal soul lives in the emotions. That's why it's impulsive, it's instinctive, and so on and so forth. And what happens is, going back to the discussion we had about the signals that come from the subconscious that fuel the emotions, if we leave it at its default position, our motivation, our ratzon comes from there as well. Our default wills, our default desires emanate naturally, instinctively, from the area of emotion, which is that instinctive response to the outside world, which is driven by an animalistic, egocentric drive, and therefore, our default motivation, for most of us and most of the time, and often, is focused on these things. Self-preservation, meaning preserving what I am now. So I don't want to get up and work hard because I might get tired. Right now I'm tired, so I'm in bed. It's driven by egocentricity often. It's more often than not driven by instant gratification. If you know that, if we don't train children not to go beyond instant gratification, that will be their default for a long time, which is why we have so much trouble today. Because we don't train younger generations to go beyond and control instant gratification. And because instant gratification today is so available, that's why when they get older, that's all that people want often. And that's why we have all this trouble with substance abuse and all this kind of other hazardous and negative behavior and destructive behavior. And like you've heard me say before, starting to educate people when they're 18 is not going to be good enough. It needs to be when they're 5. Right? Self-protection, laziness to move beyond. So that's what these things are driven by. So if we let our default position take its course, our ratzon, our will, which drives our motivation, will be negative motivation because it's coming from that animal part. It's coming from the animal area of our being, of our soul, and it's driven and fueled by these characteristics. Now, in fact, by the way, it's not just us. I'll tell you a fascinating idea. The Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Ramchal, a great master of ethics, points this out. He says it is true not only with us, it is true generally with physical things. Physical things on a superficial level protect them, are into self-preservation. He says that it's an interesting thing. There's a medrash that says that every blade of grass has a designated angel that pushes it to grow. Now, why does every blade of grass... I've always known this medrash. I never thought of this, actually. I always thought, wow, why does every blade... Okay, so sometimes we interpret that medrash to mean that the creation of God is so amazing that every blade of grass is different. So it needs its own angel, so to speak, right? But he explains in a bit of a different way. He says, you know why every blade of grass needs an angel tail to grow? Because by default, nothing physical wants to grow. It's got nutrients, it's got water, it's got everything it needs to grow, but it won't grow unless there's an angel telling it to grow, right? In other words, by default, growth is not the default position of anything physical. You know why? Because true growth, as we've said many times, true growth means going beyond yourself. And nothing physical wants to go beyond itself. Human beings don't want to go beyond themselves. Animals sometimes don't want to and can't go beyond themselves. And even a blade of grass, figuratively speaking, doesn't want to go beyond itself. And therefore, it needs that special angel to push it. No, you've got to grow. Right? And that's why he says, the Ramchal, he says this in context of a discussion. Because he talks about the weaknesses of the human being, the weaknesses that are most destructive of the human being. And he says that one of the most destructive traits of the human experience is procrastination. This is why. Because procrastination is not just a negative motivation, it's a dishonest motivation. When a person says, I'm just not interested, then you know he's not interested, and you can work with him. Or he can work with himself. He can say, you know what, I know I should want, but I'm going to work on it. Procrastination means, no, I want, I believe in it, it's important, well, and I'm going to do it. Just never gets around to it. And 6 months from now, and a year from now, and 10 years from now. Right? So it's a dishonest, it's like fooling oneself, right? Once a great Hasidic rabbi said, he says, you know, you can't really fool anyone else. He was giving constructive criticism, I guess, to some of his students. And he said, you know, you can't really fool yourself. A person can only really fool themselves. And then he said, in Yiddish, nu akunsa nair optsanair, and is it clever to fool a fool? So, but self-deception is a big thing, right? So he says that's why procrastination is the worst thing, because procrastination is falling right into the trap of a lack of motivation to grow, a lack of will to grow, even though we've talked ourselves into it that we are going to grow, just not now. And that's why it's even more destructive than completely resisting growth. Now, let me just share with you a model. I think a few years ago I might have shared this with you, but let me share with you a model where we get to understand the nature of the makeup of this animal drive that we have. There's a concept we are taught in Jewish literature that the whole world is made up of four elements. Everything is a combination of these four elements, right? Maimonides talks about this, and when God created the world, he created these four foundational elements, so to speak, and that becomes the foundation of all existence, which is fire, water, wind, and dust. And we are taught, therefore, that not only everything physical is made up of these four elements, but even spiritual things are made up of these four elements. In other words, everything, there's the concept of spiritual fire and spiritual water and so on and so forth. And not only everything positive, but everything negative. In other words, everything comprises of these four. And therefore, we are taught in Hasidic literature that even the nefesh habamid, even the animal soul, the animal drive of the person, which is egocentric drive, driving all the negative motivation, is made up of these four elements, and they bring all the problems. So the fire, we are taught, the fire of the animal soul represents arrogance. Arrogance meaning that when we have things, we have strengths, we have talents, but it's driven more for self-interest because we become superior to others, and therefore we resist giving, we resist helping, we resist being humble, learning from others, and so on and so forth. Water, we are taught, represents greed. Why does it represent greed? Because water is what makes all good things grow. There's a concept in Kabbalah where water is the life force of everything that we eat. Right? Everything that grows that we can enjoy is done by water, which is a positive thing, but it also represents a negative idea. The idea of tanuk, the idea of pursuit of pleasure. And therefore water is a symbol of greed in the negative. Wind is a symbol of just plain emptiness, purposelessness, aimlessness, where people just are empty. No drive to look for fulfillment and to invest effort in fulfillment, right? Which links into the next one, which is dust, which is heavy, which represents heaviness and laziness, right? That's the makeup of the animal soul. And therefore, that drives the emotions of the animal soul. That the emotions become negative emotions, the emotion becomes egocentric emotions. And the emotions result in a lifestyle which pursues self-preservation and greed and gratification without the willingness to invest effort to achieve meaning and purpose and a higher goal. Right? Obviously, the problem with the will that comes from the animal soul, which is our default will if we don't work at it, right? See, this part is the good news and the bad news. In other words, what I'm saying is the bad news is that this is the default human being. Not intrinsically, not deep down, but on a conscious level, this is the default human being. And it's hard to change it. The good news is we can change it. Right? So the problem with all of this is that if we leave our ratzon, if we leave our motivation to come only from that animal part of who we are, that emotional side without being guided and directed, that type of motivation, like Rabbi Twersky says, it's motivation, but it's negative motivation. Why is it negative motivation? Because it's very short-sighted and very short-term. And is transient. And that pleasure, that goal, that gain that we have from that motivation dissipates very, very quickly. And here's the problem. Here's where inner conflict comes all the time. This type of motivation, although it brings temporary pleasure, never brings happiness. Why is that? Because when we go back to the layers of the human being, the essence of the human being, which is not, doesn't function by default on a conscious level, the essence of a human being is the godly spark. And the essence of the human being has a need. In other words, although consciously by default, our motivation comes from negative places, egocentric places, and will be to self-preserve and to achieve pleasure and instant gratification, It will never make us happy, because deep down our real identity, the one identity that we're not conscious of, has a tremendous need to grow and has a tremendous need to connect to something higher. Our essence, the essence of who we are, has an unbelievable need for purpose and meaning, for fulfillment, which all of those things lead to true happiness. In other words, the things that really make a human being happy is to fulfill our real need. The problem is that if we leave the human being's journey at the default position, the real need of the human being is not the ratzon of the human being. It's not the will of the human being. The will of the human being is our conscious motivation. It's what we want and what's driving us. The problem is that when we're born, that motivation is our animalistic soul, and it's in conflict with who we really are. And who we really are is our godly spark, which has a completely different need. It's a need for fulfillment. It's a need for purpose. It's a need for meaning. It's a need of growth. The problem is, it lives so deep within us that it hasn't come to our consciousness. And because it hasn't come to our consciousness, we don't have that will. So what do? We follow the will and the motivation of the animal soul, and we land up unhappy because we're following that motivation, but it's not fulfilling our real need. And it's not fulfilling our real need, we land up unhappy. Right? Which lands up, and that's the Jewish perspective on that funny article. Because her point was, when she wrote that article, to show how ridiculous it is, that everyone will claim they want to be happy, and yet everyone engages in activities and experiences which don't make them happy. And that's exactly I'm not sure how she explains this psychologically, but this is the Jewish way of explaining it. This is the way it works. Because we have the need to grow. We have the need to do things that make us really happy. We once did a whole series on that book, remember, from Hugh Mackay, that the real happiness only comes from meaning. Meaning and purpose. Giving. Helping. Going beyond ourselves. Selflessness. That's where happiness comes, right? So what we need to do, therefore, we need to switch that around. We need to rechannel the animal soul and turn it over into a motivation that is good. Now, the good news is like this, that we don't have to destroy the animal soul. What do I mean? God designed us with an animal soul because it has a real role to play. And that's why in Kabbalistic writings we are always taught to channel the animal soul, not to kill, not to destroy the animal soul. What do I mean? The animal soul lives in the area of emotion. Now, emotions are very important. Emotions are passion. Emotions are drive. There's a fire in emotions, which is good. It fuels tremendous things. When we are able eventually to develop and to acknowledge and to bring to the consciousness a positive motivation, we will need the animal drive, the strength of the animal. As there's a verse that says, Rav tvuot bekoach shor, there's tremendous power in the power of an ox, more than the human being. We need to keep our ox, we need to keep our animal, because it's got tremendous power. We just need to channel it. And let's go back to, therefore, that model of the four elements. The four elements of fire, water, wind, and dust are not bad. They just operate badly when they live in the animal soul. What we need to do is we need to channel them and transform them to good fire, to good water, to good wind, and to good dust. And let's have a look at what that is. Right? The fire represents passion. In fact, fire very often in Kabbalistic writings represents godly love, true love. Love to a higher being, love to another human being, but in a good way, in a selfless way. Water might bring and make things that are pleasurable grow, but water represents growth. So water can be transformed to true growth, the will to grow. Ruach, which is wind, which is non-tangible, represents that part of our soul that wants to connect to something which is metaphysical, something that's higher, something that we can't feel and touch like we normally do. And finally, dust represents the concept of humility. Dust can represent laziness, but often in the writings we find dust representing humility. It's the lowest form of existence, represents that concept of submission, of surrender, because in order to really grow, in order to really find fulfillment, in order to create a positive motivation, we have to surrender to something beyond us. We have to look to something that's out of us. We have to have that humility to learn and to work hard to connect to something which we've been taught, which is given to us from a higher being, from a higher level. And therefore, we have to create a new ratzon. We have to create such a strong will coming from the godly soul, which is stronger than the motivation coming from the animal soul, and will overpower that motivation. How do we do that? We do that three ways. So first of all, before we say how we do that, in essence, how we do that is one thing. Coming back to what we said before, we have to take control of our conscious mind. We have to bypass, we have to take control of our emotions and our subconscious by letting our conscious mind control the journey. We have to learn to be thoughtful. We have to learn to think. We have to learn to create a mindset that can channel and direct and guide the conscious and the emotions and ultimately even the subconscious. And one of those thought processes is to learn to think long term. The very difference between negative motivation and positive motivation, they're both motivations, remember, is that negative motivation is short term and good motivation is long term. It's very simple. If someone provokes me, I lose my temper because I am negatively motivated. Why? Because I know that if I let them have it, I will feel good. The problem is long term, I'll create an enemy. Just to use a very simplistic example. Right? But I don't do that because I let the negative motivation take over, which is coming from a selfish, driven, emotional, explosive part of me. And I don't pause, I don't think, and I don't think this through. I don't let my conscious mind take control. Going back to mindfulness, I'm not mindful. I'm just instinctive, reactive. I'm not thinking, I'm not conscious, I'm not living in the moment, thinking it through, actually being in control of my thoughts. Because when we're in control of our thoughts, we can think long term, we can think everything through. We can be proactive and think, hold on a second, I might have gain. There's a gain in letting it have it, I'll feel better. But long term, I'll mess it up. Long term, I will destroy your relationship. Long term, I will create hate and anger around me. So it's that ability to think it through very, very strongly, and then to come to the conclusion that it's not worth the short term benefit. I'd rather replace it with a long-term gain. But the long-term gain is hard. It requires effort. It requires self-control. But it comes from a deeper place. It comes from a place of morality, of truthfulness, of what is right over wrong, and ultimately what brings me growth, and therefore ultimately what brings me happiness. Because then I fulfill my need to grow as a human being, my need to be a moral person. The second thing is, we talked before about negative motivation taking us away from our goal. And here's the problem. Often we don't spend time thinking about our goals. Right? Remember when we did the seven habits, Stephen Covey, I think it's the second habit where he says, begin with the end in mind. And true goals, when we talk about goals, what do we mean by goals? Right? True goals are value-based goals. Are goals based on values. Meaning, we all wake up in the morning and we have specific goals. I mean, one of our goals might be taking a shower. That's not a goal. That's a plan. Right? And yes, we have short-term goals and long-term goals, but we start life, we work every day one at a time, as we've talked about many times, but we have to base it ultimately in our long-term goals. And our long-term goals are value-based. Why? Why is long-term goals value-based? It's what our values are. And we need to give that thought. And by the way, thinking about our values is not just a 5-second thing. Thinking about values requires thought, it requires education, it requires a lot of thought. Why? Because it's all about the values. Personality reaction lives in the heart. Values live in the head. Values live in our conscious mind. And if you want our conscious mind to take control, the conscious mind has to be very clear, has to be filled and saturated and absolutely clear and pumped up. In the forefront of our consciousness, what our true values are, what our true goals are. Because when we think about long-term goals, inevitably what we need to think about is what is really going to make us happy? What is really going to make us free? Is it the short-term things? Is it the instant gratification? Is it the short-term pleasures that we have? And as you heard me say many times, it's not that pleasures aren't important. They are important. God gave us a world to enjoy, and that's fine. But not to pursue enjoyment as an aim in itself, as an end in itself. Yes, of course we enjoy. We're not supposed to be under stress all day. But we are supposed to work hard. It's very different. We are supposed to put at the forefront of our consciousness that our goal is our values, not the enjoyment that we have from a meal or from other activities. Because we know at the end of the day, now it's been scientifically proven again and again, that material things, once a person has their basic comfort and their basic things that they need, material things, although good, do not make a person happy. What makes a person happy are values. Right? So going back to Lag BaOmer, today's Lag BaOmer. It is fascinating to explore the lives of the two sages that are connected to Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is connected to two great sages. One is Rabbi Akiva, and one is his disciple, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Right? They were both the most fascinating, fascinating people. One of the reasons they were so fascinating is because they both lived. You know, it's interesting when you block out parts of history, or we highlight certain aspects of history, we sometimes forget the context. We're talking about Shimon Bar Yochai. He commanded people should be happy on his yahrzeit. I mean, if you go to Israel today, it's an amazing enjoyment. In Meiron, there are hundreds and thousands of people that come there to celebrate and dance all night, right? And we do it today in the context of the luxuries that we have today and the blessings that we have today to be able to do that, to have the land of Israel, first of all, to be able to travel, to have a bus transport system, to have, you know, all the things, to have the police providing security, whatever the case is, right? And we almost put Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in our own context. You know, we think of things in our frame of reference. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Akiva lived in the most horrendous time in history. It was under the most severe oppression of the Roman Empire. It was just after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Second Temple was destroyed by the Romans. And eventually, initially, when the Romans destroyed the Temple, they only destroyed the physical infrastructure of the Jewish people and were not terribly interested in their spiritual welfare. In other words, they let them continue to study and they let them... It's a whole story in the Talmud where they let them travel to Yavne to set up the Sanhedrin and the Academy of Learning because they thought it's never going to survive. You know, once the Jews don't have their temple, once they don't have their capital city, they'll just disappear. And then about 100 years later, they realized they were wrong because the Jews are flourishing. They don't have their land and it was exile and it was hard. But they have their teachings, they have their morality, they have their values, they have their learning. So they upgraded the oppression and they prohibited any forms of Jewish education and Jewish learning. Rabbi Akiva was pursued, he was under threat of death. So was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had to hide in a cave with his son for 12 years. Famous story, it was a miracle that happened, a stream of water appeared next to the cave and also a tree of caribs, charuvin. And that's what they lived on. It must be very nutritious. Imagine living on caribs for 12 years. I mean, it's one way of dieting, right? Yeah, if you process it properly. I don't think you have the equipment. Right? So Rabbi Shum, and you should understand, just to give a bit of context, that it was that era and beyond that era, in those generations, those 14 generations of the Mishnah and the Talmud, which was one of the most horrendous parts of Jewish history, and it was in that period that the Jewish people produced a Talmud, a Mishnah and a Talmud. The Mishnah and the Talmud today is the cornerstone, it's the foundation of every part of Jewish learning. You've heard me quote the Talmud many, many times here. In Jewish law, we have to pore over pages of Talmud. The Talmud has 2,000 pages, which is the foundation of all responsa, all commentary, all halachic responsa, all Kabbalistic learning even. It's the most deepest and academic piece of study and learning and literature that the Jewish people have. And it was produced in the most terrible of times. Why? And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Akiva were very happy people. Even though Rabbi Akiva was put in jail, at the end of his life he was tortured. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had to live in a cave for 12 years. And he came out and he wasn't bitter. Amazing thing. He wasn't bitter. He wasn't bitter that in fact, right? Came out and he got right to work. Rabbi Akiva, you know, one of the reasons that we have Lag BaOmer is because Rabbi Akiva, there was a tragedy. Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 students. A whole other discussion. Why? That's a lesson in itself. They were disrespectful to each other and they were great people and they were under extra scrutiny from God and so on, but they all died. So Rabbi Akiva, who himself, by the way, took a long time to learn because he wasn't that academic in his youth or he didn't have the opportunity. As you know the story, when he was 40 years old, he was illiterate and made that commitment to go and learn with the help of his wife. And he became one of the greatest sages. They had 24,000 students, and they all died between Pesach and Shavuot. On Lag BaOmer, they stopped dying, and that's why it's one of the reasons why we have Lag BaOmer. Right? So Rabbi, what would you imagine someone who built himself up like that and then loses everything in one day, with the exception of five students? He'd give up. He'd say, that's it. Go into depression, I'm done. What does Rabbi Akiva do? He picks himself up, goes to the south of Israel, takes his five students and starts all over again, and produces the Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the Zohar and all the learning that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai brought from them, with tremendous simcha, tremendous happiness, and to the point that we sit and we dance and we sing and we celebrate their lives, their terrible lives. Why? It all goes back to one thing. Because Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Akiva had goals. Now, they were very extreme and they were very holy, but we can learn from them. Because to them, when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai landed up in the cave for 12 years, he lost his comfort, but he didn't lose his values. And he was able to live by his values in the cave. Now that's a big feat. I'm not recommending that it would happen to us, but right? But it does mean that when we get up and we're a little bit uncomfortable one day, or a bit annoyed with what someone said, or we didn't get exactly the thing that we wanted to get, or we thought we were able to get, maybe we didn't get what we need or what we want physically, but we still have our values, and we can still live by those goals. We can still be good people. He sat with his son for 12 years in the cave and studied and grew to the point that when the Talmud says when he came out of the cave, he went and rejoined the Academy of Learning, and they recognized that he's on a totally different level. He was great before he went in, but he was infinitely greater when he came out, because he used the time. He said, okay, that's where I am. I've got to use it. I haven't lost my obviously, this is not the preferred location, and I'm going to get out of here as soon as I can. And he was. He did. As soon as he was able to, he left, because he had to hide. But as soon as the regime changed, he was able to leave. But while he was there, he said, if I'm here, I have values. If I'm here, I can put in the effort. I'm not comfortable, but I can live by those values. And therefore, it actually goes to the very heart of what the celebration of Lag BaOmer is, because why is Lag BaOmer a celebration? Because Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said when he came to the end of his life, he was fully happy. He said, this is the day, I know I'm leaving. He knew that he was conscious that he was leaving the world. But he said to his students, I know I'm leaving the world today, but I'm actually completely happy. Why? Because I know I've lived it to the fullest. I live by my values, and I've reached a connection, a divine connection that is on an incredible level. And he left with that happiness. And he instructed everyone else to celebrate his life, which is amazing. So, therefore, the second part of creating that will, or bringing to the consciousness the will, in the conscious mind, to guide the emotions so that we have the positive motivation replace the negative motivation, is to think about our goals, to build our values, and to understand what the long-term effect of those values are. So number one is to think long-term, but number two is to think long-term based on our values and based on our goals. And those goals and those values come from the essence of who we are. It's just about the conscious mind uncovering from who we really are what our values really are. The third thing is to create a growth mindset. Today, now there's a lot of literature on it. I'm using that phrase. Actually, it's a phrase that comes from Carol Dweck, who has written a book on that whole subject. And she's also connected with the whole idea with which they call today of neuroplasticity, which is that people, human beings, have a growth ability. And the growth ability is in all parts of who we are, including our brain. We can learn things that we weren't able to learn before. We can grow. We can change our personality because we are flexible. We are neuroplasticity. We are plastic. Exactly. We can be. We're not static. So she talks about the fixed mindset versus the growth mindset, and that's such a fundamental idea. Because in order to have that will coming from the right place, we have to develop a mindset of growth. Once we develop that, we also remember that in order to achieve growth, it requires practice and a lot of effort. And finally, in order to bring that will from the right place to its consciousness, we have to actually do what we talked about last week, is to harness the power of the levushim, the garments we talked about last week, the means of expression, the thought, the speech, and the action. In other words, so it's back to what we spoke about. It's the conscious mind developing itself, drawing strength from the essence, which is above the subconscious, and also drawing strength from the lowest part of who we are, which is action, behavior, bypassing the level of emotion. Because as we talked about last week, when we engage in activity that is purposeful and meaningful, that brings with the heart, that helps our consciousness be satisfied and happy, and that brings to the forefront even more, so it works both ways. If we have a strong will, which is a positive will, we'll engage in better behavior. But if we engage in better behavior, we'll also strengthen the will. Right? And the way to do that, of course, is to do one thing at a time. We spoke before about procrastination. One of the great time management methods that they give when they talk about people who procrastinate is the salami method. Just cut things up into very, very thin slices and do one thing at a time. When we're not motivated to get out of bed because we're overwhelmed with all the things we have to do that day, let's just talk about doing one thing that day, like the make your bed principle. Do one thing positive, help one person, make one phone call, because success breeds success. So like the ethics of the father says, mitzvah gorerit mitzvah, one mitzvah brings to another. Why? It's not just a thing because one mitzvah brings to another. It's because when you do an action, the action strengthens the heart, guides the heart, and it strengthens the conscious mind, and it builds the will. It builds the positive will coming from the godly soul, coming from the essence, and that will then inflames and guides the emotion, and in the reverse, activates and makes it more positive how we respond and how we behave. So it's about begin with one action at a time. So if we think long term, we also build our values. That's such an important thing. We need to dedicate time to understand what our goals really are, and we can review them every so often because we learn more and we grow more, so we review our goals. Create a growth mindset, and then we engage in positive behavior, manageable, one step at a time. That's how we build that positive motivation, which is driven by a positive will. Then the positive will replaces the negative will, and will drives everything that we need to in order to achieve happiness and fulfillment. But remember the principle that Ein lecha davar ha'omer b'fnei ratzon, nothing stands in the way of will, which means that we're actually capable of transforming. We're capable of building a good will, and then once we have the will, that drives everything else. Have a great week, and the next 2 weeks we'll continue on just build other aspects of this idea. Can I just